House Committee on the Judiciary, Subcommittee on Criminal Law, Tuesday, May 15th, 2001, 8:30 a.m., hearing room 357.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Law. We are going to begin with a hearing on Senate Bill 183. I'll open the public hearing. I have Senator Metzger and Scott Taylor from the Department of Corrections if they'll come forward.
This is the 17th one of these we've done. And it really is
good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We do this every 10 years. Every time we get a censor.
Get this double organized here. For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 14. Senate Bill 183 represents an important policy statement by this legislature. It affirms for the first time that individuals incarcerated for crimes against the people of the state are responsible for their own cost of incarceration, not the law-abiding taxpayers. Under our current system, the law-abiding public is twice defended, first by the perpetrator of the crime, then again by having to pay a second time. Through the incarceration of the individual. Now, in reality, we all know that very few individuals in the state correction system are likely able to afford the mounting costs attributable to their misdeeds, but that should not prevent us from clearly articulating our belief that where applicable, those costs should be borne by those individuals. Senate Bill 183 gives the Department of Corrections the same authority currently given the Mental Health and Disabilities Division to recover those costs. The reason this authority was extended to the Department of Corrections is that the Mental Health Division has a 30-year track record in implementing the policy, giving DOC a proven workable solution. As you'll hear in testimony from the Department of Corrections, those who are in state custody can be evaluated for their need to pay. SB 183 allows DOC the ability to write its own rules subject to the public rulemaking process to implement the program in such a way that it accommodates the differences between mental health and Department of Correction, and it provides accountability to taxpayers and in situations where it's appropriate, those costs are recovered. SB 183 does not require DOC to set up a bureaucratic network to evaluate each and every one of its inmates when it is apparent that they would not be successful recovery. It does not mean that families of inmates will be deprived of essential financial means of support. Mental health has established strict guidelines to ensure the success of an individual once they receive state care. Neither does 183 actually enter new ground. 11 other states have similar laws in place, including Kansas, Michigan, Oklahoma, California, Florida, and Pennsylvania. And Mr. Chair, since passage by the Senate of Senate Bill 183, may note that Multnomah County since the passage of 183, started a similar policy for Multnomah County jails. This is in no way a panacea for budget cutbacks within DOC. Those are real issues that go far beyond this legislation, but it should not be anyone's expectation that there is a gold mine ready to yield high dividends. With me today is Scott Taylor, representing the Department of Corrections. In your packet, you have testimony from the Oregon District Attorney's Association who testified of Dale Payne and Josh Marquis in support from the Oregon District Attorney's Association. That should be in your packet. Also, a statement from Joshua Marquis, who cannot be here today, who testified and provided written testimony of examples in which this could be applicable. And before I turn it over to Mr. Taylor, just will mention the Dash A6 amendments, which we asked to be included. Those were actually voted in by the committee on the Senate side, and for some reason did not get printed in the bill when it actually went to the floor. So we promised that those would be put in on the House side. With that, Mr. Chair, if there's only questions at the moment, I defer to Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Taylor. Chairman of the committee, I'm Scott Taylor, Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide information supporting Senate Bill 183. As Senator Metzger indicates, Senate Bill 183 establishes a process for the department to consider reimbursement for services to inmates. Insurance would include but not be limited to such items as medical care, room, board, administrative costs. Currently, inmate awards earned for work with preparedness are available through trust accounts, and the inmates use those funds to purchase personal items, including items. The Department of Corrections will establish rules to govern the program. The intent at this time is to limit the use of this authority. In those cases where resources that could be applied to prison cost of care are readily available. We do not want to spend all of our time trying to determine each and every person's financial status outside of the Department of Corrections. So our goal is to work with those where we can easily identify that additional assets are available. As of February 7th, 59% of the inmates had $10 or less in the trust account, and another 34% had $200 or less, leaving roughly 7% of the inmates with balances of $200 or less. So as you can see, it's a small population that we would actually be looking at. I believe it's essential that inmates have sufficient resources to support themselves upon their needs and be able to pay the cost of supervision and quarter on obligations. Therefore, a targeted effort recovery appears to be appropriate, and we would certainly guarantee that we would look to the orders of the court for victims, restitution, other such costs before we were to attach costs for the Department of Corrections operation. So with that, I'm available for questions.
Which, by the way, Mr. Chair, is a last comment that you can make is in the Dash 6 amendments that were erroneously eliminated from the Green Bill. Thank you. Are there questions for either Mr. Taylor or Senator Metzger about the bill?
That's really worth. We need to pick up.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sean. Is there anyone else here in the audience that's here to testify on Senate Bill 183? Okay, hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 183. We'll now open a hearing on Senate Bill 133. And Representative Betsy Johnson.
Thank you very much for coming to our area.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We are so far out of the mainstream, we have a harder time in our election to officials because of the difference.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state representative from House District 1. I'm here today on behalf of a constituent, Mr. Kim Johns. Mr. Johns owns a company in St. Helens that makes ballistic dry suits for the federal government. He has contracts with the Marines, the Coast Guard. He is a GSA contract supplier, which means that he provides these ballistic dry suits to state and federal agencies, including the FBI. The unique situation here is that Mr. Johns is also a convicted felon. I'm offering this amendment in the hope that it will make it possible for Mr. Johns to be in possession of the product that he now manufactures. I have checked with the bill sponsor, Representative Lowe, as well as worked with Senator Minnis in offering the amendments that you have before you. He has a company that employs 25 people in St. Helens with $3 million in revenue coming into our community. Since 1985, Mr. Johns has been an exemplary citizen. He has enlisted the support of Senator Gordon Smith, Congressman David Wu, our sheriff, the military department, and a number of others in seeking presidential relief from his conviction. He was appointed by Secretary Pena to a district escort council where he serves as vice president and is in the middle of a four-year term. I'm hopeful that you will consider these amendments to Senate Bill 133 in order to bring relief to Mr. Johns and preserve the jobs in my community.
There's an awful tough job these guys do. I know it's tough.
Are there questions? Thank you, Representative. Are there questions for Representative Johnson about the Dash A6 amendments?
The only thing I can offer, Mr. Chair, about the Dash A6 amendments, these were crafted with the guidance and help of Senator Minnis, and I owe Representative Lowe a great debt of gratitude. Her staff was outstanding in helping me get these drafted to meet Senator Minnis' concerns.
I think would be our next governor of the state of Oregon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really think this gentleman has done a great job. He's lived all over the state. He's done
May. Do you want me to do it from here or from there?
I know that.
Wherever you'd like, Representative. Right there if you'd like to proceed.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, I brought this bill at the request of two outstanding police officers in my district, one from Gladstone and one from Oregon City, Frank Grace from Gladstone and David Ratto, who's here in the room today from Oregon City. I don't see Frank just yet. But this bill is an important bill because it will help keep citizens on the street safer from being caught in crossfire, and it will also make the job of our public safety officers a little bit safer when a felon dons, or somebody who intends to commit a crime dons body armor to go out on the street and do their bad thing. It ups the ante in terms of violence significantly and puts many, many people at risk, including themselves, because in the act of trying to apprehend them, it increases the likelihood that the criminal will not make it into the halls of justice if there's going to be a gun battle. So this bill is a good public safety bill, and I would ask a favorable consideration of it.
Thank you, Representative Lowe.
They revalued it at $28.
Is there any questions for Representative Lowe?
So you figure if something like
okay, I'd like Paul Snyder.
We would lose. You would have about 3% of the tax.
On Apple Road and Mr. Ratto, the three of you would come forward.
We need people like that we have here in Eastern Oregon, and we don't need to extend.
Oh, sure. That's fine. Mr. Ratto, would you mind waiting just briefly? Okay, thank you.
To get elected and let you have a good person to scout bills right in the mainstream of a big populated area. So it is a problem. And we do have
good morning. Who would like to begin?
I'll begin, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm employed by the Judicial Department. I work for the State Court Administrator, administering the Indigent Defense Services Division. We're here this morning on the Dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 133. These amendments would require mandate that local public safety coordinating councils establish what are commonly referred to as early disposition programs. Early disposition programs primarily are geared toward lower-level first offense misdemeanors and probation violations. You'll be hearing from Lane County District Attorney Doug Harkleroad this morning, who originated early disposition programs in Lane County in the 1980s. The programs he has in place, I feel, are models for the rest of the state. The Dash A5 amendments would provide the criteria and other broad purposes, rather, for these local public safety coordinating councils to develop early disposition programs. The amendments then, Dash A5 amendments then amend existing law with regard to criminal arraignments and also probation violations so that to enable the early disposition programs once developed by the council to be implemented. The A5 amendments also have a reporting requirement, which we feel is important to assess the efficiencies to all system players in the criminal justice system. Early disposition programs, Mr. Chair, real quickly, resolve cases quickly, generally at arraignment, because a district attorney like Mr. Harkleroad or Mr. Schrunk in Multnomah County, where we successfully implemented early disposition in Portland for almost all of the misdemeanor cases, with the exception of domestic violence, and for probation violations, it takes a district attorney who is in a position to come up with offers that are attractive to individuals who are making their first appearance in court, whether it's on a probation violation or whether it's on a generally a misdemeanor charge. I should say in Portland, we do have a possession of controlled substance, a felony, early disposition program that has been operating, I believe, now for 3 years. It may be 4 years. So it takes a district attorney such as Mr. Harkleroad. It takes a judge who is in the first appearance court who commits to the fact that the vast, vast majority of the cases in which the district attorney makes these attractive offers will in fact be disposed under that offer the same day. And finally, our experience has shown that it takes an experienced defense attorney to staff that courtroom and provide advice to individuals who are seriously considering accepting one of the offers. We think, and the Chief Justice of the State Criminal Justice Advisory Committee in the past has thought, that early disposition programs done correctly are an efficiency for everyone in the system. And on behalf of the Judicial Department, I would respectfully request that you support the -85 amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Christian. Who wants to be next?
I'd like to be next, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Harkle-Rode.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Doug Harkle-Rode. I'm the district attorney in Lane County. And for those of you who don't know me, and I don't know you, I've been the district attorney for over 16 years and a professional prosecutor for 27 years. What I would tell you about this bill is that what I think this does is it will encourage us statewide to do speedy justice with cost savings. And what I really like about this bill is the word that says outcome. We're going to measure some outcomes here. And what I believe is that statewide we spend lots of money in the corrections area and we don't often know what the outcomes are. I'm going to give you an example of just one quick disposition program in Lane County where on nonviolent misdemeanors, and that's all nonviolent misdemeanors in Lane County, if the person has not too bad a criminal record, if they want to opt into a program where we don't even charge them with the crime, and they pay $125 to a for-profit company and do a correspondence course in what I call How Not to Be a Criminal, but it's basically an attitude adjustment course written by a guy with a master's degree in education out of Utah. What we know is 91% of those people never come back in the criminal justice system for as long as we've been running the program. And you say, what do you mean, statistical sampling? No, we run every person, and we have run every person for over 5 years to determine that. When I say run them, I mean check their criminal record. They don't come back 91% of the time. By the way, this one is so quick, it happens at the first arraignment, but they're never charged with a crime, so there is no indigent defense cost at all. And there is really a big carrot for them. They opt into the program, pay the $125, they're successful in 90 days. We keep the case open for another 90 days, case open in the sense of we hold it in abeyance for 180 days. And if they're successful, we never file anything. And 91% of the time it works. We protect the victims. If it's a theft case or there's some restitution, that's a condition of the quick disposition program. So that's the kind of thing that can be built with a statute encouraging district attorneys and judges around the state and local public safety coordinating councils to do something. And there's lots of benefits to it, and I don't see any downsides after having been doing this for many years in Lane County. I think we could do better, and I think if we have this statute, we will do more. And it will be quicker, and it will save us money, and we will get good outcomes if we build the programs right. So I would recommend that you pass this, and I know in principle that the Oregon District Attorneys Association supports quick disposition programs. It's just that we haven't had a chance to run the A5 amendments through the association. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harkle. Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. This is an issue on which the District Attorneys Association, the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and AOC and the Indigent Defense Coordinator have been working now for several weeks. Unfortunately, when we get into the details of the issue, sometimes we miss the obvious. And one of the obvious things is to check with the sponsor of the bill, and that's something we didn't do. And that representative, well, I apologize. I don't have much more to add with respect to this particular issue. It's something that we endorse, we recommend to you. It provides for providing for the interests of the state, protecting the interests of the defendant, and creating a more expeditious process dealing with criminal cases, and we recommend passage of this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Are there questions for this panel on the Dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 133? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to recognize my district attorney, Doug Harkle Road. He does a bang up job down there. Of course.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. I'd now like to bring forward Bill Hauser from the OCDLA. You want to come forward, Bill?
Good morning. My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm here to, I guess, express our concerns on the Dash 5 to make sure that when we talk about an early disposition type program, we have to make sure that those people who are charged with crimes, who do make it to their arraignment, are given the opportunity to have counsel available to explain to them exactly what it is they're doing if they go into some kind of program or take some kind of plea right away. Typically, a defense attorney will want to have the ability to take a look at the police reports, see if there's any kind of legal impediment to factually. We'll take a look at the charging instrument and also have a chance to actually sit down with the person that we are now talking to, making sure that they can make a decision based on their mental ability and their rational thought process in order to make that rational decision to enter into some kind of early disposition process. So that's really the concerns that we would have, is just make sure that there's counsel there so the person is not, so the person knows what they're doing and has advice in doing it during the process.
Mr. Hauser, is it your reading of the A5 so that they don't provide that the person will have an opportunity for counsel?
It does provide for that, I believe.
Okay. So you believe it does provide for their opportunity?
I just want to make sure that our concerns are on the record.
You're comfortable with the Dash A5 amendments as it provides for counsel for someone who's been charged?
Yes.
And would be subject to, I guess, what we're calling early disposition?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Hauser before we let him go?
I guess I do have some questions.
Representative Lowe.
Has anybody had the good sense to run the A5 test? Anybody in the Senate, too, to make sure that they're not going to kill this bill?
Representative Lowe, I can tell you that they've not. I've had conversations, and I believe others have had conversations with the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee who would be amenable to the Dash A5 amendments. And I will commit to you that we won't let this bill
croak.
You have the dubious honor, however, Representative Lowe, of having one of the very few remaining bills in this committee that has a relating clause relating to crime, which makes it a very important vehicle for this stage of the session.
So this would be the criminal Christmas tree bill.
Well, one might suggest that it might be. Any other questions for Mr. Hauser before we let him stand down? Thank you, Mr. Hauser. Now, Mr. Ratto and Brian DeLashman and Mr. Frank Grace, if the three of you would come forward.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'll get started while the other two gentlemen are sitting down. I'll be extremely brief. I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations today. Pleased to be sitting next to these two gentlemen. They'll tell their story, the original reason for this bill. I just want to let you know that of the priority bills that the Oregon Council of Police Associations has been involved in this session, this is one of our top priority bills. We strongly support it. It was very nice to hear the chair indicate that the amendments that were just discussed didn't bog the bill down. That was my first look at them this morning. My reaction was, I don't know what they do, but I would be concerned if they would stall this bill. So with that, I have no objections to the A5 or the A6.
Great. Thank you. Who would like to go next? Mr. Grace?
Chair, representatives. Good morning. Excuse me. This is a bill that I...
Mr. Grace, can you identify yourself
for record? Excuse me. Officer Grace, Frank Grace, with Gladstone Police Department. I'm a Reserve Police Commander with the Gladstone Police Department. Okay. Chair and representatives, this is a bill, Senate Bill 133, which I became involved in early on in 1998 when I read an article in the American Police Newsbeat newspaper, a nationally syndicated newspaper, I read an article in which Elite Golf out of California was in the process of getting a bill passed in the state of California that would outlaw the possession of bulletproof vests by convicted felons. I was in contact with Lee and also an officer out of Detroit area, and since 1998 I've been working with both them and most recently with Representative Kathy Lowe to get a bill, a similar bill passed in the state of Oregon. The whole intent and purpose of this bill is to establish an Oregon law that would make it a crime for certain criminals, with few exceptions, to possess and or wear bulletproof vests, or for anyone to wear body armor in the commission of a crime. From my experience in law enforcement, not only in the state of Oregon, but in California as a full-time officer, this is a bill to me that only makes sense. Police officers wear body armor for a specific reason, that is to protect the lives of community members and their own lives. They're very recognizable. They have a specific function to perform. I believe citizens should also have the right to wear body armor, but I also believe that those committing crimes, those who have been convicted of certain crimes, do not have a need to wear body armor for obvious reasons. Again, I've been working on this since 1998. Officer Dave Rattle, who's going to testify next, has limited his support. And I have, I'm up to page 10 now of supporters from across the state. 10 pages of supporters that represent not only law enforcement agencies, law enforcement associations, but also private citizens. I actually have one convicted felon here who endorses this law as well. So the law as it stands, I think, is a very good law that should be passed for not only the law enforcement community, but our communities as well. I was talking to my contact in California, the author of the California law, and many states now are in the process of establishing a similar, in fact, he's similar law. In fact, he's working on a law at the federal level. He wanted to let me know that if we continue on the path we are going now with Oregon, we could be the fifth state in the nation to pass a law, that I think, again, is the common sense law. And for our state, very proactive. Again, for not only for law enforcement, but for the community as well. It just makes a good sense.
Thank you, Mr. Grace. Mr. Ratto. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Officer Dave Ratto. I'm a member of the Oregon City Police Department, and I'm here also in support of this law. In 1995, I was involved in a situation in Oregon City at the intersection of Highway 213 and Washington Street. The individual that I confronted was wearing concealed on him a bulletproof vest, and he was carrying two sidearms. There was a shootout involved, and I really, after all these years, can't put into words the feeling that you have, first of all, when you have to draw your gun and fire it at another human being. But when you're firing and hitting that human being and he's not flinching, then what goes through your mind is indescribable. This law would put a stop to that. I see nothing to hamper the passage of this. It not only protects the officers that are out protecting the citizens of the state, but it also protects the citizens. As police officers, we're responsible for every bullet that we fire. And in a shooting situation, we are also held responsible at some point in time for the bullets that the bad guys fire. If the bad guys are wearing bulletproof armor or hard body armor, or as in the case of Officer James Gelf in San Francisco, that a felon also was wearing a bulletproof Kevlar helmet, also had 3,000 rounds of ammunition, and I believe it was 6 or 7 assault weapons.
You can imagine over a period of an hour that or so that that incident in San Francisco took place, how many bullets were fired into buildings, into cars, into apartment houses full of innocent people. All of that simply because the defendant, the felon, didn't fall when he was shot the first time by Officer Gelf. The need for this law is evident, and we're all intelligent people here. And fortunately, most of you, and I hope most of you, will never. In 1995, I was involved in a situation in Oregon City at the intersection of Highway 213 and Washington Street. The individual that I confronted was wearing concealed, had concealed on him a bulletproof vest, and he was carrying two sidearms. There was a shootout involved, and I really, after all these years, can't put into words the feeling that you have, first of all, when you have to draw your gun and fire it at another human being, but when you're firing and hitting that human being and he's not flinching, then what goes through your mind is indescribable. This law would put a stop to that. I see nothing to hamper the passage of this. It not only protects the officers that are out protecting the citizens of this state, but it also protects the citizens. As police officers, we're responsible for every bullet that we fire. And in a shooting situation, we are also held responsible at some point in time for the bullets that the bad guys fire. If the bad guys are wearing bulletproof armor or hard body armor, or as in the case of Officer James Gelf in San Francisco, that a felon also was wearing a bulletproof Kevlar helmet. Also had 3,000 rounds of ammunition, and I believe it was 6 or 7 assault weapons. You can imagine over a period of an hour that or so that that incident in San Francisco took place, how many bullets were fired into buildings, into cars, into apartment houses full of innocent people. All of that simply because the defendant, the felon, didn't fall when he was shot the first time by Officer Gill. The need for this law is evident, and we're all intelligent people here. And fortunately, most of you, and I hope most of you, will never have to confront a situation like I have to, because the aftermath stays with us to the point that sometimes we wish that we actually didn't survive the shootout. Surviving can be even worse. So if we can minimize the ability of people to own or possess these, that not decent citizens, not people that are under protective custody, but just the people that intend to inflict serious violent harm on our citizens or on our police officers will be taking a step that, as Frank indicated, is spreading across the United States more rapidly than we anticipated. And so I thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you. Are there any questions for any three of these witnesses?
Mr. Chenevo, I just want to thank Officer Grace and Officer Rado for their hard work and Brian DeLashen for the support of the union. And I really appreciate very much the legwork that you did for this, and
expensive. And I also want to thank you for keeping me safe, by the way.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Here's our last witness on the interview, Russ Spencer from the Oregon Sheriff's Association.
And then the representation that...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer for the State Sheriff's Association, and also on behalf of the Oregon Law Enforcement Legislative Committee. And I'm here to testify in support of the bill for all of the reasons that were very eloquent to describe Officer Gray and Officer Ratto. In addition, I just want to offer the committee the assurance that we have reviewed the Dash 6 amendments, and we are very satisfied that public safety interests are well served with these amendments, that we don't feel that they offer any threat to public safety, and are very supportive of those, and I urge you on a positive consideration of this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. Are there any questions for Mr. Spencer? Okay, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 133. We're now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 168. I have Ann Christian from the Judicial Department signed up. Is there anyone else here to hear or to speak on Senate Bill 168? Please come forward.
Benefit everyone in the district of the I think it makes a lot more sense.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, I am Christian with the Oregon Judicial Department. And I had thought that someone would be here from the DA's Association, but I think I can do this. Senate Bill 160.
You can always bring Mr. Harkin in if you run into trouble.
That's fine. Thank you.
You didn't expect to make any comments.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we let Ann go, and then we'll move to you, if that's all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the backup. Senate Bill 168 is the result of a task force that the state court administrator put together during the interim to look at the issue, and it was part of the result of a budget note, and it was to look at the issue of pretrial release. Oregon, and I suspect many other states, have a pretrial release system that is disconnected at times. There are county employees in some counties who are responsible for pretrial release. In other counties, such as Wayne County, there are state judicial department employees. And the task force took a look at the differences between different release programs. And Senate Bill 168 responds to one issue that they identified, and that issue is some jails are to the point as far as overcrowding that under Chapter 168 they are authorized to release people who are in custody under specific guidelines set forth in the statute. And in Marion County, my understanding is in particular, there were some difficulties with managing that release process. So Senate Bill 168 is an effort and does to correct that type of problem and does two things. It allows local sheriffs to provide people who are released under what are called these forced release agreements to actually sign a piece of paper, which they currently don't have to do in every single county. And that piece of paper indicates what the person's next court date is. Another beauty of it is it does require a signature by the person being released, which in some counties is currently not required. What that signature allows then is the second of the two things that the bill does, which is the potential, if the individual fails to appear at that court appearance, for the district attorney to charge the person with felony failure to appear or misdemeanor failure to appear. The classification depends, as far as failure to appear, depends on whether or not the person was originally charged with a misdemeanor or a felony. And I would say that on behalf of the Judicial Department, we support Senate Bill 168, and if there's any concern about the fiscal impact, Criminal Justice Commission, and we worked quite hard, quite frankly, on the fiscal on this, and there are definite system savings to the extent that you stop the churning of individuals being released, picked up, released, and picked up. And the fiscal impact on Senate Bill 168 is underneath the $50,000 limit.
Thank you. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
I will.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Katie Seaver, and I am a deputy district attorney speaking on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We are in support of this bill for the reasons that have already been stated. Specifically in Marion County, the sheriff has the ability to authorize release of individuals in order to manage the population in the jail, which is on a daily basis overcrowded. However, that authority only extends in managing the population. So when inmates are released from the Marion County Jail, those individuals are given a court date to appear, but they are not given a binding release agreement, which would thereby allow for the crime of failure to appear to be charged. This bill essentially closes that loophole in the law and allows the authority of the sheriff to give release agreements to inmates in the jail when they are released. As is already stated, this allows us to then charge the crime of failure to appear and allows us to manage our caseloads a lot easier. We don't have individuals who simply don't show up to court over and over and over again, thereby using police officers' time to arrest these individuals, process them into the jail, have them immediately released, and then have the court, district attorney, and defense attorney time wasted in waiting in court for these individuals ultimately to never appear. It ultimately is going to save a lot of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions either for Ms. Christian or Ms. Seaver about the bill? No opposition testimony, Ms. Senator, I assume.
Okay. None.
Good. Thank you both very much. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 158 and open a public hearing on Bill 657 and ask that duo of Russ Spencer and Bill Houser come forward. You guys even look like you're wearing the same colored suit today.
We called each other this morning.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Houser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have asked that the -A4 amendments come before the committee. These amendments would allow that if a inmate have received an award for some kind of claim against the state or the county based on either personal injury or civil rights, would be the two examples, civil rights claim, that the government could not obtain a counterclaim or request for set-off on those funds. And so that's the concern that we had on the bill, and that's why this particular amendment is before the committee, the subcommittee. Excuse me.
Thank you. Mr. Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer for the sheriffs. We are bringing before the committee the A5 amendments, which you see. The A5 amendments essentially embody what was the substantive part of House Bill 2738. And what this does is relates to our what's commonly referred to as pay to stay. In the previous legislative session, the legislature passed a bill which allows us to charge inmates for the cost of their incarceration. And in order to do so, there has to be a method in which an inmate can challenge the amount that we are billing them. So, for example, if we present them with a bill for 57 days and they say, no, I was only incarcerated for 47 days, there has to be some method of addressing that issue. Current statute would require a civil hearing, which would require us to go before a judge and have an attorney present and so forth, and is somewhat cost prohibitive for the amounts that we tend to be seeking. So what 2738 does is requires that each county must set forth a grievance procedure so that we can deal with this issue administratively. I am not aware of anyone planning to testify in opposition to this.
I think it's
a fairly straightforward procedural fix for a problem that we're dealing with. In terms of Mr. Houser's amendments, we have no problem with those amendments. As I discussed them with one of our sheriffs, he said we should be doing that anyway. So I think that you have a fairly clean bill before you if you're looking favorably for the amendments.
be happy to answer any questions. Thank you. Are there questions for either Mr. Hauser or Mr. Spencer?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, please represent Cheryl.
This is my bill. This was my bill in 97 that established the procedure that the Dash A5s are eliminating for establishing the process for collecting.
How do you feel about that?
Oh, I don't know. I got a little problem.
Well, perhaps we should have some discussion. And the A5s are brought forward by the Sheriff's
Association. The Sheriff's Association.
Mr.
Chairman, and, you know, 657 is at the request of Jim Maine, who is the Douglas County Sheriff. So it is, at least from the proponent, 657 considered a friendly amendment.
And I'm thinking ahead. Now we know.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Shirley, do you want some time to review the data?
Yeah, I would please.
Okay, I'd be pleased to give it to you. Okay, we are going to let me ask. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 657? Hearing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 657 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 780. And I would ask that Rick Knapp, Jacqueline Zimmer, please come forward. Okay, Ms. Rand, do you want to come forward? And I also have Cheryl Pellegrini on the list. Cheryl still here?
Mr. Chair, she had to leave, but DOJ is sponsoring this bill. But she had to go.
But she had to go. Okay, well, good. We'll get you three up there.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Knapp. I'm a senior deputy district attorney at Washington County. I've been a deputy district attorney for 16 years, and I'm responsible for the prosecution of elder abuse cases in Washington County. This proposed bill would allow hearsay statements by people 65 years of age or older to be admissible in court when they may or may not be available. What this proposed legislation does is it basically furthers the evolution of family intra-abuse, if you will, intra-family abuse. We now, under 803-18-AAB, are allowed to offer evidence in a trial for children under 12 years of age, if they're unavailable, or up to 18 if they are available to testify. We'll allow the introduced hearsay statements by victims of domestic violence, and this proposed legislation would allow hearsay statements by elderly people 65 years of age or older to come into trial if they're available or unavailable to help prosecute elder abuse cases as narrowly defined. They are criminal mistreatment of first degree cases and theft cases only. 803-18-AAB has been through the court system and has been found to be constitutional. There's no confrontation problems with the defendant's rights. This bill has a great amount of support from not only the District Attorney's Association, DOJ, Adult Protective Service workers, and other people in the community. I think the most important thing, though, is that it allows elderly victims who are unavailable at trial to have their day in court. In Washington County alone, this last year, we've had three cases that the victims died before the cases went to trial. Just over a month ago, we had to dismiss a case because the victim died, and there was no other way for us to present the case because we had no hearsay exception like this bill would allow us to have to offer the victim's testimony as to their position on what the funds were or whether the funds were allowed or were not allowed. So I encourage you to pass this proposed legislation.
Good. Thank you very much, Mr. Knapp. We'll take all your testimony before we open up for questions. Ms. Zimmer.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer. I'm the director of O4AD, that's the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and we're here in support of this bill as well. A couple of reasons that we're so in favor of it is that we do not have enough protective service workers to handle the more than 4,000 reported cases that come into our offices each year. We earn those protective service workers based on this of last year's numbers.
So with the increasing demographics, numbers of seniors and people over 85 in Oregon, tracking down protective service issues gets more and more difficult for us all the time. It's kind of an awkward system for earning employees, and this bill will help us in rectifying some of those cases that we are addressing. So that's one of our primary reasons for supporting it. I just want to give you a quick example of vulnerability that I encountered just last week. I happened to be on the street by Willamette University, and an elderly man pulled in a car in front of me and got out and just sort of looked befuddled and handed me a piece of paper. He was, in fact, looking for a particular parking lot at Willamette University. He was about 80 years old, he thought, and he was looking for someone he wasn't sure, but they had given him a list of directions. What ended up happening was I drove his car for him, and it could have been anybody that helped him. There are lots of interesting people that walk along State Street every day. I could have taken advantage of him in a number of ways, and it frightens me to think of the vulnerability of some of these seniors. And they have to trust other people. They're sort of short on resources sometimes. Part of the time he was listening, he was very lucid. The rest of the time he really wasn't. He wasn't sure. I suggested we put our seatbelts on, and he hooked the seatbelt that was between the two of us in the front seat. Actually, there was nobody there, and at some point he realized there was no one there and kind of chuckled about the fact that he had hooked the seatbelt, and then he wanted me to know that if you drove the wrong way on a one-way street, people showed you no mercy. And it was kind of funny, but it really wasn't. So, you know, we're just abuse cases are sort of way out of control, and if this still helps, then we're supportive of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Zimmer. Ms. Rand.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Phyllis Rand with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I'm here in support of the bill today. The commission is very interested in this bill and believes that it will be a step in the right direction to help with our seniors. And elder abuse, physical, sexual, psychological, financial, or neglect, is a serious concern for victims and their loved ones. It's also a most serious problem for our society. Victims of abuse have been shown to have shorter life expectancy than non-abused older people. And elder abuse leads to premature dependence on a long-term care system, particularly the public-funded system. The commission believes that in the cases where a frail elderly victim's memory may be failing, or the victim is becoming mentally incapacitated, it's both fair and desirable to be able to have a third party testify as to what a victim said immediately after the crime was performed. So the Governor's Commission on Senior Services supports the passage of Senate Bill 780. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Brand.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir, Mr. Knapp.
If I may continue on that same subject, I prosecuted child abuse cases for 14 years. And I thought I would never see a victim more vulnerable than a child, as you can imagine. But what I've learned is that's not true. The victims that we're seeing in all these cases are much more fragile than children. Children are resilient. They'll bounce back. They usually do. Elders don't bounce back. I've seen that in almost every case I've prosecuted, I've seen a decline in the elder person's health to the point where sometimes, like I said, they're not able to come in court to testify. And people don't realize that. I didn't realize that until I started doing elder abuse cases, and I want you to know that because as soon as they become victims, they're aware of their victimization, their health declines mentally and physically. And that's why this bill is incredibly important, because if they can't make it to trial, at least someone who they told early on when they were still competent or didn't suffer from dementia or whatever can come into court and help support them and testify. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Could I ask? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So this will be an excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule that would cover the elderly, or if they are not available for testimony, either because of mental incompetence or death.
It's not exactly the excited utterance exception. That's still in place.
Uh-huh.
But there are lots of statements that don't qualify under the excited utterance exception. The excited utterance exception is based on the fact that the statement was made close in time to the incident, and the person was still under the stress of the incident. This is not necessarily the case.
It doesn't require stress.
Well, no, it doesn't require stress, and it doesn't really necessarily require it be made close in time either to the time of the incident. For instance, I have a case that the woman that's pending right now that involves $228,000. And this occurred over a period of about a year and a half. Now, at one point, after she paid, about a week or two after the last payment she made to the offender, she then told the neighbor. And it wasn't necessarily close in time to all of the financial exploitation. And certainly, I mean, she wasn't necessarily under the excitement of the loss of money, but I'm sure that was still with her. But the fact that she made the statement concerning the giving of the money to the suspect, and it relates to the theft to the crime. Now, if she's not able to testify in court, if we can establish that the statement was reliable, if we can establish that it's corroborated, and we give our notice that's required by the statute 15 days before trial, then, for instance, that those statements that the victim made to her neighbor would come on in.
So that statement might be admissible even if she had made it while she was mentally incompetent?
Well, the statement, if she was, the court would have to look to determine what her state of mind was when she made it. And if the court found that it was reliable and corroborated, then it wouldn't be that she was incompetent at all. It would be admissible. If the court found that the statement wasn't reliable or wasn't corroborated, let's say, for instance, she was incompetent even back then, the statement would not be admissible.
Okay. Just wanted to understand.
Thank you.
Representative Sherwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I understand that this statute establishes equivalency here, all things being equal, between, on the one hand, witnesses who are chronologically or mentally under the age of 12 and those who are 65 years of age or older?
I would have to agree with that.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't know if we're tracking the same thing, but I'm worried about it. I think inherent with my thoughts here are how do you establish the reliability, how do you establish that these things are corroborated. I don't see that these are foundation types of things which must be established before this testimony would be admitted. And as one witness indicated, some of these witnesses are mentally incapacitated when they're making the statement that their memories have failed. I'm worried about the addition of reliability prior to the admission of these out-of-court statements.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, unfortunately, I don't think that you have before you the complete text of 803-18-AAB. But within the statutory makeup of 803-18-AAB, the statute provides that the statement has to be reliable, and it sets out how to determine reliability. It also talks about corroboration and how the statement has to be corroborated. So the judge, for instance, in a pretrial hearing or outside the presence of the jury, would go through all this. And for instance, the state would have to call witnesses, potentially the person themselves or the doctor or a caregiver. And we'd have to jump through these statutory hurdles, before the judge would allow this into evidence. And that's how the defendant's confrontation clause, issues are protected, because the court has to make those findings. Now, for those victims who are 65 years in age and older, who are in great health and have no mental problems, they will be witnesses in court. So they will be subject to cross-examination. So the fact that they're testifying and their statements they made to third parties would come in, isn't a problem either because, again, the person, the witness himself, is there in the courtroom to be cross-examined, so that's not really a problem. Either. So either way, the suspect's rights are protected. Plus, if you have a victim who is 65 years of age or older who isn't going to be a good witness or isn't a competent witness, then this allows those cases to be successfully prosecuted. And, you know, some children 12 years of age and younger, I've had witnesses who are 5 and 8 years old who are outstanding witnesses. And I've had witnesses who are 5 and 8 years older who weren't even competent. And the same thing applies to people 65 years of age and older. We hope that our older population gets old and is healthy and is competent. But we know at some point in time everybody's health begins to fail. And unfortunately, in elder abuse cases, here's the glitch. The people who become victims of elder abuse cases already have some vulnerability. And that's what makes them victims. That's what makes them susceptible to elder abuse. They're already frail, or they're already mentally dimensional. They're maybe already suffering from maybe some dementia. They may have very lucid moments most of the day, but they're vulnerable to a stranger, or maybe they're vulnerable to a family member, or a relative, as opposed to it. But that's what that and all, most of your cases start it. And so that this is why this statute protects those folks.
Any further discussion? Okay, thank you very much. Hearing none, we'll have a public hearing on Senate Bill 780. That's basically our agenda for today. We won't be working any of these bills by the committee of the adjourned.
So it's important to us. Now, my understanding is that the issue really is community of interest. And a couple of things that I've heard tonight, and I really wanted to speak near the end so I could hear others' thoughts on this, and there's some thoughts that had not occurred to me. But it's been very valuable for us to be served by a state representative and a state senator in a very rural setting, and that's what we have right now. I think our options are to be less rural right now. And so a lot of the interests that we have are very similar to that of Grant County and to Crook County and other places because of the rural nature here. The fact is that the size of our county is similar to the size and population of other counties in the current configuration, whereas if we were to go to other configurations,
or the doctor or a caregiver, and we'd have to jump through the statutory hurdles, before the judge would allow this into evidence. And that's how the defendant's confrontation clause, that's how his confrontation clause issues are protected, because the court has to make those findings. Now, for those victims who are 65 years of age and older, who are in great health and have no mental problems, they will be witnesses in court. So they will be subject to cross-examination, so the fact that they're testifying in their statement they made to third parties would come in isn't a problem either because, again, the person, the witness himself, is there in the courtroom to be cross-examined, so that's not really a problem either. So either way, the suspect's rights are protected. Plus, if you have a victim who is 65 years of age or older who isn't going to be a good witness or isn't a competent witness, then this allows those cases to be successfully prosecuted. And, you know, some children 12 years of age and younger, I've had witnesses who are 5 and 8 years old who are outstanding witnesses. And I've had witnesses who are 5 and 8 years older who weren't even confident. And the same thing applies to people 65 years of age and older. We hope that our older population gets old and is healthy and is competent. But we know at some point in time everybody's health begins to fail. And unfortunately, in elder abuse cases, here's the glitch. The people who become victims in elder abuse cases already have some vulnerability, and that's what makes them victims. That's what makes them susceptible to elder abuse. They're already frail, or they're already mentally diminishing. They're maybe already suffering from maybe some dementia. They have very lucid moments most of the day, but they're vulnerable to a stranger, or maybe they're vulnerable to a family member, or a relative that you're close to. But that's what, that and all, most of your cases start this. And so that's, this is why this statute protects those folks.
One of the central issues in the next decade.
Any further discussion?
Representative and state senator. And Greg, your point.
Okay,
about,
thank you very much. Hearing then, we'll
public hearing on
Senate Bill 780. That's the police our agenda for today. We won't be working any of these bills today.
It's for us to the investment of knowledge that we have to maintain here. It's definitely a community of power. And another one, Senator Ferrioli mentions, is that when you take a look at the historical development of our county, I would argue that the county that we have the most similar historical development to is Grant County there. Development of both counties, basically being on the discovery of gold and the wealth created from that and then the communities that grew and then the agricultural support from there on out. Alisa Bonebreak, our librarian, always has some interesting insights, and I had not considered this before today. But I think the fact that the Idaho border is currently represented by three state senators is really significant there. I think the alternative would be one or two. I think the more representation we can get on this part of the state, the better. I'm inclined to agree with her there. And then finally, I would just, I don't know that the Baker-Morrow Regional Partnership is necessarily in jeopardy as a result of any configuration here, but you're absolutely right, Representative Smith, that it's going very well. And our interest with Morrow County is basically focusing on getting things done that will make a difference. That's what Baker County's been about for the past decade, and that's why we want to be in a district that allows us to keep getting that done. Thanks again for being here.
Anything else? Well, we hit the dusty trail. This has really been good. It's been good for me. It's been good for all of us. I hope it was good for you. So thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
I
Actually, they're constitutional. It's the Constitution, one person, one vote.
The question was asked, is there a mechanism for distributing the representation by a mechanism other than population? And originally in Oregon's history, we had a distribution other than by population. The Senate was districted by geography. But in pursuit of some judicial review, it was determined that the only constitutional configuration for Oregon was one person, one vote, meaning that you had to have proportionality between the House districts, two of them, of roughly equal population, and the Senate district, which would be one of them. And so we ended up with a constitutional interpretation that depends, or that requires that each senator represent approximately the same number of voters, and that each member of the House of Representatives also represent an equal number of voters. And that was the comment that the chairman made, one person, one vote, so that each senator meets on a roughly equal plane. That way, in the Senate, when I speak for you, my vote in the Senate carries equal weight to a senator from Portland, whose district may only be 20 blocks in one direction, as opposed to 6.5 hours in one direction. Obviously, we are outnumbered by population since it's centered in the Willamette Valley. The equation that Senator Harper and I looked at in the Senate every day is that there are three Eastern Oregon senators and one Central Oregon senator that we include, which is really nice. And so there's four of us east of the Cascades in the Senate that represent your interests, and there are eight members in the House that represent your interests east of the Cascades. So obviously, we need to be very supportive of each other in our interests and be very vocal about your interests there. And that's why the communality of interests is not a trivial issue. It's a very important issue. So I have been perfectly happy with the idea of, okay, how about 36 senators? We could put another row in the back of the Senate and have one senator per county. And the problem there is then that you'd have one senator for Multnomah County, one senator for Clackamas, Washington, et cetera, and they represent, those six counties represent half the population of the state of Oregon. And you would be a...
What's the problem?
Yeah. You would not have the constitutional issue of one person, one vote in that case. But we have, in fact, experimented. You know, the Constitution of Oregon has been interpreted to be one person, one vote, but not the Constitution of the United States. There are two senators per state, no matter what the size of the population. I kind of like that idea myself, but... It would take an initiative, ma'am, to change the Constitution.
I'm just trying to get this done based on current law.
Oh, take the easy way out.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming this way. Thanks.